Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast.
Back at it for another edition of the show. So good afternoon, good evening, good morning. Whenever you're consuming this content, thank you for being... Well, you know what? That's a good question. When do you listen to not only this podcast, but others? How do you consume content? When do you consume content? I mean, I'm genuinely interested. Matter of fact, I might do one of those questionnaires. You know, when you listen, how you listen, what service you use, what you like about the show, what you don't like, and you don't get to say, I wish it were longer. No, I hear that all the time. It's the one thing that people will say to my face of what they don't like about the podcast. And, you know, you got a second? I do. It's a legit question. So let me clear that up. Podcasting is, you know, the great thing about it is it can be, A, what you want it to be as a content creator, but also you can really cater to your, you know, to your audience. Unfortunately, sometimes people, not just in podcasting, but in general, will listen to what I call the cocoon. The cocoon is like, best way I can describe it is it's a vocal minority. Sometimes people will hear very loudly what a few people are saying and think that everyone else thinks that way. And really, that kind of defines social media, doesn't it? But, you know, you have to consider everyone. And the people who wish the podcast to be two hours, and a lot of, you know, and there's the legitimate, like, why don't you do it that way? I understand that. Because there are a number of podcasts who do very well in that format, but that's just one format. There are a number of different statistics I could throw out of how long the average New Englander commutes. You know, if they listen to the podcast commute only, or do they listen in the shop? See, this is why I'm asking these questions. I could be completely wrong. And then there's the human engineering part of it too, which this is probably way too inside baseball, and this is what happens. You didn't even ask me a question, and I'm already over answering the question you didn't ask. But, well, here we are. At any rate, you know, the average attention span, and don't get me started with attention spans, we're human beings, computers, phones haven't changed us that much. We like to think they have, and it's an interesting narrative, but the average human being's attention span lasts 52 minutes. Well, maybe not their attention span, but it's scientifically proven that people are ready for something new after minute 52. With that said, that's not why the podcast is 52 or under minutes. And some people will say, well, it's because you want to draw out the season. Listen, it would actually be easier for me just to release the thing unedited and in one glut. You know, one of the reasons why this even started and continues to this day is to preserve the stories of the people who experienced them first or second hand. Let's just take the 52-minute rule. If you... in this case, get 45 minutes or 50 minutes of story, and you take two or three items that you remember out of that episode, well, you'll remember them for the next episode where you might get, you know, two or three new ones. Whereas if I dropped a bunch of, or as if it was just 2.5-3 hours, scientifically it shows that you're going to retain the information a little bit better in smaller doses. But hey, I could do that questionnaire. It could be 100% you're a moron, do it the other way, and I don't know, maybe we just end up doing it that way in future episodes, seasons, whatnot. This season though, I mean, we're really hitting our stride. Thank you for all of the shares. I know I've expanded on shares in the past, and I can't beat that drum enough. And how it helps get the word out of the podcast. It doesn't cost you anything to hit the share button, especially on Facebook. That's generally where our the strongest interaction comes from. Sharing it on Facebook, whether you're listening on, if you're listening on Spotify, I don't know how Apple works because I hate Apple, but letting your social media followers know that this is something worth their time is really just, it makes it work. And the algorithm loves 5-star reviews. Don't give me a one. Don't be a dick. Don't be a fuck and give me a 1-star review. That, it just, don't kick me in the jimmy that way. If you want to contribute to Patreon too, it's patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast. Got some new members here in the last couple of weeks. What you'll get is an early drop, a Tuesday drop instead of Open Trailer Thursday, and some Open Trailer Podcast merch, which basically now is a decal. But anything that you can contribute, 100% goes back into the podcast, and it's promotion and all that stuff. So, and maybe even making the episodes longer. I don't know. So this one, holy smoke, this one is... I didn't see this one coming. I knew that I wanted to get Trevor Sanborn on for a while, and I'm really glad we got Trevor on. Trevor's been one of the top super late model drivers in the last 20 years here in the Northeast and even further. And everybody knows Corey from Facebook, but I think there's an entire generation that's never, they've only heard Corey Sanborn, and the dude's such a character that I'm glad that Corey came along for the ride. It was supposed to be about Trevor, but man, we ended up digging into some of Corey's stuff, and especially here in episode number one, we talk about their dad Butch, his connection to one of the most dramatic moments at Beech Ridge Motor Speedway, how Trevor got going. We talk of Corey's stuff, and oh man, it's fun. It's part number one of the Sanborn Brothers on Open Trailer Podcast. Enjoy.
Big bowl, like it's a true oval.
Yeah.
Well, no, I guess it's more like it's circle, kind of the way you race it, but it's got a lot of space. It's pretty wide on the back stretch. They call it the concrete palace, obviously. Everything's concrete except for the track.
Yeah.
In the old days, they used to flood it and race boats there.
Yeah. Did you ever race a boat there, Corey?
No.
You're old enough.
He's old enough for that.
Yeah. So it's in a circle. Is that a lot like Oxford?
Yeah, I would say, but it's not. It's probably got some more banking.
Are you doing the 250 this year?
Yes.
You sound excited about that.
I guess I am. I mean, We wanted to do a throwback of Jeff Stevens' car because, you know, Rick was the owner of his cars
right.
over the years.
Yeah.
And it's 50th anniversary.
That's the biggest thing. But
250 this year.
Mm-hmm. You know, we just had Jimmy Brown on the podcast, and I don't know if you knew this or not. This was a truth bomb to me. Do you know where your number 44 came from?
No.
So Jeff Stevens, obviously, in the number 44, for the longest time, Jeff wanted Chummy Brown to work for him at his business, right? And so there's a little crossover. Chummy Brown's number, when he raced, because he did drive for a while, was number 44.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where Rusty and Wayne and all those guys got awesome. The 44. So technically, your number 44 is tied to Chummy Brown.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how have you done in the 250 anyway?
The first year I raced it with Moody was in 06. We finished sixth a lap down. Then they didn't have the lucky dog, so we got kind of...
Yeah.
And that actually might be the best finish.
I think you were maybe
eighth. I finished eighth a
recently.
Few times, tenth.
We got Trevor Sanborn on the podcast today. His brother Corey has also stepped in too. It's funny, you know, I was doing a little... Trevor was the main guest. And then I realized I got to reach out to Corey, who might have, you know, it seems like wherever you go, Trevor, Corey's right along. And Corey, you're obviously, a personality in your own right. You know, you obviously have your own driving, you know, career as well. So I figured we could kind of tag team a little bit. So it's a pleasure to have both of you on the podcast today. You guys come from, you are a racing family. Can't
yep.
say you come from one. But your dad, Butchie.
Yes.
You know, we are kind of Beech Ridge centric. Doesn't mean we're going to only talk about Beech Ridge stuff. But, you know, when I look back at like some old photos of, you know, you when you were young and you when you were young, and then we see Butchie photos. I mean,
yeah.
They got to date back to like the 60s at Beech Ridge.
Yeah. I mean, he was there in the 60s, but he didn't own any race cars till the early 80s.
Hmm.
But he's definitely had a lot of experience and a lot of times there.
Who did he drive? Who did he have cars for?
So he told me today, I went over some things with him. He,
yeah.
The first car he owned was in 1981.
Yeah.
And Bear Reynolds drove for him the first race.
No kidding.
and just one race.
Oh, okay.
And then
Walt Pugsley
drove two races after that.
Yeah.
And then he put Jim McClure in the car for one race that year, and then Don Brown took over.
Did your dad own the car when Don Brown had that big crash?
Yes.
So that was a big repair bill.
Yeah.
That was the first car they built when Don started, and they built it right in Don's garage over there in Baldwin. Like three of them, Phil, me, Dad, and Don Brown built it over the winter.
So
I think it was built out of pretty light construction stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it folded quick. You know, I've heard 7 different versions of that particular crash. And for those that haven't seen the photos, we'll attach them to the podcast so you can check them out.
I have a picture somewhere of Tink Concrete. You remember Tink?
I know Tink, yeah.
He standing there looking at it like in amazement before the ramp truck got there.
Well, I looked at it and I didn't see it happen in person, but I was like, did that guy live? You know,
I think he got a broken finger and a couple teeth knocked out. Mm. That was it.
So what happened in that crash anyway?
Throttle stuck.
Yeah.
Yep. It was early in the year. I don't know how early, second, third week, something. Yeah.
What was that car number? 80? 20. 20.
It was a Pontiac Ventura on a Chevelle frame.
Wow. That's very specific.
Well, that's how Corey rolls.
Yeah.
Normally he calls me Freddie.
So I'm reading Facebook, and I think anybody that follows you guys on, whether it's the professional page or the personal pages, they you guys, for all your race teams, and it's gone on to your next generation too, you all have nicknames. I can't keep track of who's who. Why can't you just call yourselves regular names?
Just a habit. Just a habit of, before the podcast's over, I'll probably have one for you.
All right.
That is a wicked good question, but I don't know. Everybody needs a nickname.
Yeah, no, I
have no explanation.
But where does Freddie come from? Why do they call you Freddie?
I think my grandfather, they call him Freddie.
He's Eddie.
Right. Okay.
So why are you Freddie Corey?
When I was a little kid, I believe there was a Freddie Fender song, old country song, and he just came out with it one day and called me Freddie.
Okay. And you're Eddie because?
They named me after my Uncle Ed.
Oh, all right. Yeah. So it's not like Cousin Eddie from the National Lampoon. I figured they were off movies.
No.
That's a good one, though.
Or country songs.
No.
I always, whenever I'd see Eddie, I would just think, okay, it's Eddie Money, but it's a different spelling.
Right.
But it could be Cousin Eddie. I don't know.
I think it only was funny to us because it rhymed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did Butch get into racing? What got him interested?
I would say because he started going with Russ and Beverly with my grandparents.
We had some family friends that were, Walt Pugsley, who we called Pudge, David Spencer, a bunch of people from Parsons Field raced, and I think he wanted to get involved, but he didn't really want to be a driver. He just wanted to own.
Yeah. So this is the early 80s, and, you mentioned the list of drivers that he had. Was he committed to a certain number? Where does the 29 or the 67 come in?
So he told me that 20 originally was how he got the car.
Yes, it was on that Camaro that he bought from Steve Sanborn.
Yeah, I get it.
16 was Don's number.
See, Don previously drove for J.B. McConnell, who owned Beatridge. They had numbers 24 sometimes if Cusack weren't there. And 16 also was J.B.'s number. So Don drove that, and when he moved on to my dad's team, they brought the 16 number with them.
Yeah. What was his tie to the Miettas, Butchies?
I just friended him over the years at Beatridge and was their tire guy. When Corey was racing, he was doing tires for Corey, Mike, and Little Mike.
I stopped for a few years in the mid-90s when Logan and Libby were born, and we were parked next to Mietta, so Dad still went to the races, and he just helped Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a minute there, he did like my tires, Mikey's tires, and Big Mike's tires.
The same night.
Right. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's owning cars.
Right.
Too. Wow.
Right.
So, Corey, even though Trevor's our, I guess, our main guest today. We your career fascinates me.
Because don't it all.
I think that's, you know, it's obviously we have a lot of information on Trevor and everybody's seen you compete the last 20 years, but I think there's a whole generation that know of Corey that never saw him race,
right,
but see him beat the daylights out of his equipment and wonder like how that, like, we're not crapping on you.
We're just wondering
how you got involved in all those messes.
Oh, I just was horrible. No other explanation.
Yeah.
And you asked about the 67. That was
your number, wasn't it?
It was, but after Don Brown stopped, Jimmy Gary came on board to drive.
For dad,
yeah. So me and Kurt are 14, 15.
Was that the 66?
Yep. It was blue. Yeah. I brought the pictures, but they're out in the truck.
That was a beautiful car.
Yeah.
Jimmy won some races, then they stopped racing, and then in 88, he teamed up with Bob Harrison as a driver. And Bob was 37, obviously.
Yeah.
And we just picked a number that was close, kind of like his.
Mm-hmm.
47 wasn't available, and it just ended up being 67.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's how you became. So where did you start off?
Stock cars was 1988 at Beatridge. I had a brand new Steve Levitt built car and was way in over my head.
Yeah.
So that didn't go that good for me. We ended up blowing the motor. Ricky Harrison ended up buying the car. And then the next year I got a Limited, which suited me. It made me happy because I wasn't as intimidated to drive.
You started in the late model sportsman division.
Yes.
With just coming from go-karts.
Yep.
That's something that can happen today.
Yeah.
I don't think in the 80s anybody did
that. Oh, it was unheard of.
Kurt did it. And Kurt was Gary.
Right, to modify.
Yeah, and he won immediately.
Yeah.
I wasn't that same type of driver.
No, it wasn't. Tell me about some of those early days. You say you were horrible, but why were you horrible?
What I remember is the car had, it was the fanciest of stuff that Steve and Gardner were building.
Hmm.
And it had a manual rack, no power steering. And I remember asking Gardner about it, and he said, if you aren't strong enough to steer it, you probably don't belong in one of these cars, which was awesome because it was the truth.
Yeah.
And Bob had a car that was a twin to it, except it was a Camaro Snout, so it had stock type steering and it steered real easy.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously I wanted to switch cars, but that never ended up happening. Bob Harrison was great to us. Even Trevor remembers in later years, he was just awesome as a, like another father figure.
A crew chief, a friend, everything.
He was just good, amazing to us.
And you guys come from, were you always from Parsonsfield?
Yes.
So, Western Maine, you know, you're about an hour removed from Beatridge, so.
45, yeah.
Yeah, did you feel like you guys were outsiders at all? Or was it that Butch had already kind of laid the groundwork?
Dad already knew everyone down there.
Yeah.
You know, associated with everyone, so it felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you end up on the ACT Tour, Corey?
Well, as I got a little older, Dad just wanted to race 3 days a week. So in the mid-90s, we got a new car from Stan Meserve, Howcar.
Not hit the microphone so much.
And we raced at Oxford Friday nights, Beatridge Saturday nights, and wherever the ACT Tour raced on Sundays.
And sometimes the ACT Tour raced at Thunder Road.
Yep.
Can you tell me about the incident that I think everyone has seen, but at least let's get your side of what happened with Derek Lynch and that big wreck on the front stretch.
Yep, that was 1994. I had an old Dillon car that I was driving for Sherman Thing from Lyman. Late in the race, Derek is, you know, I don't know if he's leading, but he's up front.
Yeah.
And him and Mike Rowe or Brad Layton or some of the big boys get an altercation, and now he's sideways in the front stretch, like right at the start-finish line. And here I come and T-bone him in the doors, in the right side door. And I'm trying to put the car in reverse to back up, and he jumps out, and it's like beating my windshield. And Junior, and it was the assistant flagman for the ACT Tour at the time.
Junior Niles?
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
Ended up manhandling him off the track, and he somewhat recently I listened to a podcast out of Vermont.
Yeah, it was the Uncommon guys.
Deeds.
Yeah.
And this is 25 years later, and he apologized, which was awesome.
Isn't that weird how you guys never forget stuff like that?
Yeah. And yeah. I had messaged him, and I told him that I forgave him the next week by the time we went to Plattsburgh.
Yeah, because you had already wrecked your
probably
stuff
wrecked
again.
Someone else, yeah.
Did you ever race Sennair?
I never did. We were going to go there with the new car in 95.
Yeah.
And I remember asking Bob Harrison why he had the body so braced up.
Yeah.
You know, roof, windshield. And he said, you will want that when we go to Sennair.
Yeah.
We ended up ruining a motor at Lee opening day. So we never ended up doing the whole tour. Just Beech Ridge and Oxford, Thunder Road.
What was your dealings with Tom Curley?
Loved him to death. He was mean, but he was fair to everybody.
What about you specifically? You're wrecking his top young guy, and he loved Derek Lynch.
Oh, Derek is his son-in-law.
Yeah.
Tom was stern with Derek. He made him pay for the windshield.
I mean you.
Oh. We had a good relationship. We joked. He called me a dub, which was awesome.
Yeah. That's kind of a compliment coming from him, isn't it?
If he calls you anything, yes. Yeah. When I wanted Oxford July or something in 95, and he was the first one in my window net.
You want an act feature?
No, just a Saturday night pro stock deal.
Yeah.
It was on a Sunday because of a rainout.
Because he was running the track at the time.
Yeah, from the top booth, he was the first guy to the window. It was pretty awesome because, you know, he was just the guy's like an icon.
Trevor, do you remember that day that he won that race?
I was there, but I was actually out in Bob Harrison's camper in the parking lot. For some reason,
it had been raining.
It was a little later or something in the day, and us kids were young. I mean, he was only eight or something, and we were just out there with, you know, Bob's wife and
Debbie,
and I remember him winning. I just don't remember a lot about it.
Yeah. You know, it seems it's interesting that you and Russ Nutting have such a bond, right? But it doesn't seem like any of the Russ Nutting things rubbed off on you.
Correct.
You know, exactly. I mean, like, did he ever get you aside and say, hey, no, maybe you should try this and do it this way?
Russ has always been so quiet. I was actually intimidated by him because he didn't talk. Recent years, I've come to understand he don't talk to anyone.
Yeah. Have you listened to his podcast?
I loved it. Yes. Yeah. That was the first one I listened to. And, you know, it was amazing.
It was hard work. It was very rewarding work.
Yeah.
But to get some of there was a lot of editing in that podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm so thankful that David Oliver helped me out with that.
That was good of David to do that.
Without David, I don't think we would have got 30. It would have been it would have been 30% of what it was.
Yeah.
You know, and Dave made it so much better. So you know, Corey's racing, you know, you're kind of getting the hang of it. When do you hang up the helmet? When your kids are born?
They were born in 93 and 95. I raced into 96. We were transitioning, when I say we, my dad, from the logging business to metal recycling and car crushing. And I meet Big John Clark.
Johnny's dad.
Yep. We just basically stopped racing and keep my fix, I go help him, and I become Johnny's crew chief for a year.
Is this pro truck days?
A little bit before. This was, it was 98. He was making the switch from Wiscasset to Oxford just because he wanted more publicity, you know, get noticed a little easier. 99, I ended up with a limited, so I went back racing for a couple more summers at Oxford, and then I got a job working for Chris Kennison on a race car. This is when he's starting to race, so I'm missing out on his stuff at Beech Ridge because I have a job that I'm getting paid to be at Oxford. So
tell me a good Johnny Clark story that you don't think anybody else knows.
New Year's Eve of 99, when the world is supposed to end.
Oh, I remember that, Y2K.
Johnny comes down, and we have a New Year's function at my Uncle Kurt's house, and Johnny made this big New Year's ball out of newspaper and Christmas lights.
Yeah.
Wrapped it all up. We saran wrapped it and threw it up over a beam in the house so that we could lower the ball at midnight. Johnny was a lot of fun. I mean, he still is, don't get me wrong. my daughter was madly in love with him, and she was two, and he brought her home a plastic ring from the bubblegum dispenser at Ames and gave it to her. It's just always been a...
She still has it?
Oh, no, I don't think so. But we still talk about it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, she still says, I can't believe how much I loved Johnny back then. It's
Well,
he's just one of them stories that sticks with
me. He still is a stud. Still,
yeah, absolutely.
That's good to see him kind of come around and have some really success.
So now Trevor's son, Talon, who was three, almost four, has a Johnny Clark shirt that he wears to the races. And we just got his picture taken
with
Johnny
that happen?
Last
just
week.
Organically or?
No, we were pitted next to, we're always pitted next to Johnny most 250 weekends. Actually, the last couple of years up to Oxford in pass races.
Yeah.
And Nikki was walking by the Johnny's trailer one day or something, and Johnny goes, I got a shirt for the boy.
Yeah.
And she's like, all right. And, you know, she just puts it on him a lot when we go pass racing, and he loves it. It says Johnny Fast across the front.
And does she know any of the backstory?
No, not really.
Or didn't at the time.
No, no, absolutely not.
Oh, cool.
She does now, though.
Yeah. And we the Benjamin family is awesome, too. We've met a lot of good families from touring.
Did you ever do the Pro Truck Tour with Johnny Clark?
I did not, because that's when I went racing limited.
Okay.
I mean, we were still friends and hanging out and stuff, but...
Was he winning races at this time, or was he still struggling?
He didn't really struggle his first year at Oxford. We got some top threes. He didn't win. But he ran good and was a contender for the championship that I believe Chubbuck won. And then when Johnny got to the trucks, that's when he turned the wick up a little and started winning all the time.
Yeah,
And then I think right after that was when NEPSA or...
That Pro Truck Tour was cool. I wish they would have been able to develop a little bit more.
I liked it a lot, too.
Yeah. I mean, it was a good... I think it was economical for the racers.
Yeah.
And it was a good show. I mean, it wasn't... every single weekend, but you know the schedule was aggressive enough.
Did you get to see them race much?
Yeah, they raced. Where the heck did I see them? Was it Wascasset?
I only ever saw them at
Boxer. I never got to see them race.
Yeah.
I just don't remember it at all. Really, I remember the name Pro Truck Tour, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
much
Phil
about
Rowe
it.
Was the guy that put it together.
Remember that too.
He was a
Johnny
good dude.
Won a lot. Doug Averill from
Augusta
area.
Steve Prescott.
Yep,
did pretty good too. Yeah, I know Justin St. Louis actually did a whole story time on the Pro Truck Tour. I've yet to listen to it, but it's on my list. Also on the list is talking about Trevor. You know, Trevor, you kind of you're hanging out, you're watching your big brother. When do you have a moment where you're like, okay, I want to do that someday. I want to drive.
I always had that, even when I first started karting. Just had the idea. Didn't know how we were going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Financially or anything, but
you didn't understand money.
I didn't understand none of it. You know, where I was 98 when I got the go kart and with the Pastores at Beechridge when they ran all that, and then you know I ran go karts right up until 2003 when I first got in, when Andy first let us come to Beechridge and run the pro stock,
right?
And
who were some of your friends in that go kart family? Because there were a lot of people.
There was
that came
a bunch of us together, you know, Joey, Derek,
Mike Nealon.
Yeah, Mikey Fowler, Corey Williams. Me and him raced together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joey and Mikey were a division or two above us, so we just watched them. Obviously, we didn't race with them, but there was a ton of people. Chummy Brown was always hanging around there with Lindsay. She was racing then.
Yeah,
you know, there's. The Babs.
Alan.
You know, my cousin
Alan.
Yeah,
kind of a who's who of racing.
Alan Tardiff.
Yeah.
You know, all of us. And then we ended up all racing at Beechridge later on in Pro Stocks, it seemed like.
It's funny. I mean, even today when, you know, you're out there with Pass or, sometimes it's even Granite State, I can look back on a lot of those go-kart days and I'm like, it's like a all go-kart
I know it.
Top four.
Yeah.
You know, guys that used to compete against each other. But, you know, you go from go-karts. How do you do in go-karts? I forgot.
We won a lot. I don't know.
So you
won
took
five championships between two tracks, Box Shop and Beechridge. And I don't even know the races.
It's all coming back to me now, not because I remember watching it, but because the first day that you and I ever met, you probably don't remember it. But the reason why we met was because of your dad.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing my pit walk. I was the announcer at Beechridge. And, I knew your dad a little bit. I forget from where. Maybe
was this? You mean Saturday night racing or go karts?
Yes, 03.
Okay.
So your dad pulls me right over, and he's like, and I just totally, I'm just remembering this story now for the first time in years.
I think I remember this.
Oh my, okay, well, what's your version?
Well, I think I remember him grabbing you and say, Andy Austin. And,
and same with the Butch voice.
Something like that, and it was nuts. But
oh, we should have
and that's how we got introduced.
Yeah. Andy Austin, come on over here.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and I remember meeting you, and you looked like you were scared shitless.
Yeah,
you,
no.
It was.
I think I was never scared of driving. I just think I was really shy.
Yeah.
You know, back then I didn't talk a lot. You know, didn't really know what to talk about.
Well, you didn't have any life experience.
Exactly. I mean, I was 15 years old.
Right. And you're thrown into the the sharks. That is Bub Billidoo.
Yeah.
You know, Bobby Babb.
Billy Rogers.
Billy Rogers. All those guys that have been competing.
Mike was still there, weren't he?
Big Mike was still there right around
then. Yeah, yeah. He was still doing it with Gutter.
Yeah. And Steve Carey was there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a big, big division. And I think that those dudes have been competing with each other for 10, 15 years.
Oh, yeah.
And it's before, I think the other person, there were two guys that stick out to me that were, three guys that stick out to me that were really young. It was Mikey Maeda. He was the first to break the mold, in the 80s, early 90s. But the only other guys I remember are Alan Tardiff, Jason Fowler, and you.
Yep.
But you're younger than all these guys.
Right.
How old were you when you started the pros?
So I don't know how exactly went down, but Dad had a conversation with Andy Cusack and had some type of an agreement worked out. As long as I had my permit, driver's permit, not license, I could race.
Right. I know what he's going to say. His birthday isn't until August, and race season starts way before August.
And you had to be 16. Well, it doesn't matter now what we say, but, I raced that whole season up until August, at 15 when he should have been 16.
I think Alan Tardiff is the same way.
I think they did let Alan do that. I do.
Yeah.
But I don't know if Andy just saw that I wasn't an animal on the racetrack and trusted that a 15-year-old kid could do that or what? I don't know.
Yeah.
But he let us do it, and we won a race that year.
Yeah, I want to jump right into that because I specifically remember that night. With the way the Beech Ridge handicap system worked is, you would start up front, and you have the big dogs right behind you the whole time. And it's probably like a 40-lap race,
yep,
I think.
It was.
And you end up winning that race at the age of, were you 14 or 15? 15 years old. You win the race. Can you tell me about what was going through your head that night?
It was an autograph session night. I remember it. And we started outside pole. I don't remember who was on the pole, if it was Jay Sands or who it was. Mm. But I remember Barry Meserve, he didn't help us then. He helped us a few years later. He walked up to me and said, I know you're going to get it done tonight. And we did.
Yeah.
Miraculously. But I don't know if there was cautions that night or not, but they didn't even have anything for us. And that car was just a kind of a relic. It was just Bub Billidoo originally built it, but it was around for 10 or 15 years. It was a big spring car, and it was just a relic, but it still went pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, so if that car dates back to the 90s.
It does.
Yep. It's an old Billidoo car. I never knew that. So you win. It's the 29. Why are you the 29?
Kind of a weird story, long story short. I don't know. But my birthday is the 11th. My brother Dale's the 11th. My mom's is the 2nd. My dad's the 2nd. My mom's the 9th. 2 and 9 was 11. 11 was taken. So we went with 29, the both of us, when we started karting.
Wow.
Kind of odd, but that's the way we did it.
Yeah, that's cool. So
all of our, basically, Andy, all of our favorite numbers were 11. Mine and Dale's, because we were born on the 11th. Mm-hmm. And then Dad and Mom's birthdays equaled 11. And so we just went with their 2 and 9.
What do you guys do for the Powerball?
I just random.
Yeah?
I'm a random guy.
Wow.
Easy pick.
I'm surprised that you don't do, because you're so in the numbers.
Yeah.
No 67. Can you play 67 in anything?
No. I would never. It's been on its roof too many times.
Yeah, I was going to say, Corey, what's the worst crash you've been in? You've been in a lot.
I rolled over twice at Oxford. Both times it was I was climbing the left rear tire of somebody.
Yeah.
Coming off two, once in a limited, once in a pro stock.
What's the secret to getting around Oxford? You, both of you.
Be smooth. Don't overdrive.
Corey, you know? Don't drive exactly over the hood of
what
somebody.
He said.
Slower is faster, Ant.
I guess it's amazing that the limited success I did have was at Oxford because I never won at Beechridge.
It's such a technical track.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so weird. And from a driver's standpoint, this is, you know, a lot of the people we have on the podcast. I mean, I'm really excited that you guys are on here. I'm thankful to have every single guest we've had. And it's great to have all the history. But it's another thing to be able to ask somebody who's out there racing with a Bubba Pollard, who's out there racing today, how sensitive the racetrack is and how quickly it can change and how technical that track is. Can you get into that
a little bit? It's the worst racetrack, most temperamental racetrack I've ever raced on. And I've been to a lot of racetracks from Florida to back here to Michigan, you know, Tennessee.
Yep.
I don't know what it is about the asphalt or the – I don't know. But you can go up there on a Friday night and test and run 15 twos. And you go back Saturday morning, afternoon when they open the gates, you might break a 15-8. Same tires, same car.
Yeah, same weather.
The weather could be fairly close.
Yeah.
And it's just not the same.
How sensitive is the temperature of the pavement to Oxford to make making a difference?
It's real sensitive. I mean, obviously hot, it's always greasy, and the cooler it is, you got more grip.
And when they run the modifieds on Saturday night of 250 weekend, is that ever...
Their tires change the handling of our cars because all that rubber's down on the track. And then we go out and pick it all up and throw it around everywhere.
So here's a layman question. If what you do on Friday doesn't matter, why do competitors spend the entire day practicing for something that doesn't matter?
Listen, You shouldn't. We all shouldn't.
Right.
Should show up Sunday, and you got what you got.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to make a race car. You show up there on Friday, and you're not good, and try to get it right at the track. A lot of cars show up at the track. They're fast when you unload them out of the trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can tweak them here and there and get a tenth out of them, but if you're 4 tenths off, you're not picking that up at the racetrack. You better go home and reevaluate what's going on. You know,
What is your first memory of the 250 as a spectator?
I was there when Gelinas won it in 96.
You
I don't
say
remember.
With quotes.
Well, there was controversy. I don't know.
Yeah, you don't remember.
I don't know anything about it, but I remember Gelinas winning.
Yeah.
And I don't remember 97, but I went up there with my grandparents 98, 99, and 2000 when Ralph won them.
Yeah.
And I remember them. My grandfather loved Ralph Nason.
Yeah.
And it was his hero. And, you know, I remember Ralph getting out of the car in Victory Lane and standing up and people booing him and him going like this and saying, "Bring it on, boys."
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
Ralph was a character.
He's
probably lighting a cigarette, too.
Yeah.
Have you heard his versions of this podcast?
No, I don't think.
He's got like 3 episodes, and he does not hold back. But it was the day that the Capitol was raided. It was January 6th, 2021.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Unity, we did it right across from the racetrack. And that's, you know, no man's land when it comes to the internet. And I'm so thankful that it is, because I couldn't imagine doing that podcast with that character while that was going on.
Awesome.
It would have been a completely different podcast.
So awesome.
Yeah. So we left off racing-wise where you had picked up that win. Who's your sponsors? Who's funding this?
Back the first – I mean, my dad sponsored the car until I got driving for other people. And then he helped out a little bit. But 03 – in 04, we had that Bob Bilodeau car, and Dad worked for Polarized
New England.
He got some money out of them to sponsor and help out local, just at Beechridge while we were racing. And then in 05, we heard Travis Keel had a distance car for sale, and we went up and looked at it, and my dad bought that for the 05 and 06 season at Beechridge. And that's when we really come to life and did well, because just Jeff Taylor's cars were the best around, and still almost in New England they are, you know.
Was that when you started winning, like, because you won a bunch of opening day races? and you started, you know, was that, that was right around that time?
Yeah, I don't know, 05 and 06, I think, I don't know which year I won some opening day races there, but I also won two in 2010, the first two, and then I gave up.
With that same car.
Because Rick Moody called me.
Yeah.
And wanted me to come drive the car, so I gave that one up, which was the same night Bob Bilodeau died. I won that race, and Andy held me on the front stretch to not go in the pits because we're pitted next to each other. Mm. And
oh, I remember that.
You know, he just wanted kind of the, you know, everything to smooth out.
So what was that night like from your perspective, the night that that Bob passed? It was a, if I remember right, it was a 100 lapper?
No. No, it was just a regular 40 Saturday or 50 lapper.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, because you would run the extra distance if you had 21 cars.
Mm-hmm.
So 50-lapper, Bub finishes sixth, and then pulls off. You win the race.
Yep.
And, I mean, I know that, you know, now just thinking about it out loud, I mean, there's definitely some lineage to, you know, you were driving his old race car. Did he help you out at all when you first started?
Yes. I had a good relationship with Bub.
What's the biggest thing that he told you about driving?
You know, he just told me to be smooth at Beechridge and stuff, but he was, I was always on him about setup stuff because Bob built his own cars.
Mm-hmm.
And 05 and 06, we raced against him. I didn't, you know, we still talked to him, we're friendly with him, but it was after the fact when I went past tour racing with Cushman in 07, I got more friendly with Bob. I'd stop over his house. Bob let me drive his car for a few races there. I don't remember what year it was, maybe 09 or something. But we got really friendly with him, him and Terry, Tommy Nason, you know, all a bunch of great people. And that night that we won, after, you know, doing my interview on the front stretch, I was going to climb back in the car. And Andy Cusack wouldn't say, I said, he said, well, let's wait right here for a few minutes. And I just thought it was odd to sit on the front stretch like the night's over.
Mm-hmm. Did they make you come in the back way?
I don't remember, honestly, but he said, you know, let's just sit tight here for a few minutes. I'll let you know when you can head in the pits. And they, I don't know, 10 minutes or so, he let me go in the pits. And I think I went the same way down by his pad. But I noticed the ambulance there. Didn't really think a lot of it because I just thought someone got hurt, you know. Or,
right.
Yeah. Jack fell, the car fell on him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I rolled back up and I don't remember who told me. And then I see Tommy Nason and he was, you know, pretty up. He was crying. And,
yeah, Tom,
like the rest of us.
Yeah. And for those that don't know, Tom and Bob had that relationship, that 1-2, that A to B relationship.
Friends.
Brothers for, I mean, as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and I'm sure it dated even before that. So we're talking 2 decades plus,
yes.
3 decades plus.
Yeah.
You know, to lose a friend like that, and you, you know, continue to race that year. They leave his pit space open.
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your head when you pull in on a Saturday night, that very next Saturday night, and for the Saturdays afterwards?
Well, that's what happened. Right at that point, I didn't go back the next that year.
Oh.
That's when Richard Moody asked me to drive his car on the tour, and I went and did that. Hindsight, yes, I loved racing for Rick, and we did well, but that was the year we won them 2 opening day races. We had a really good car. We should have stuck it out and tried to get the Beechridge champion, NASCAR championship, you know?
Why didn't you stick around?
I just thought that racing the past tour, you know, you get more recognition, you know, and Rick had great race cars, and that's just, I wanted to go that way. I, at this point, kind of wish I didn't. I wish I stuck it out at Beechridge that 1 year, but you can't change that.
You know, I think we can all relate to, you know, depending on where you are in life, really, making a decision that, I mean, in that moment, you think that that's the one that's going to catapult you to the next level or get you somewhere that you couldn't go if you chose the other thing. And
you know, years go by and you look back and you're like, geez, you know, I really wish I would have had that moment, or I wish I would have done the other thing. But you'll never know. I mean, that's just life. But hey, cool stuff in stage one. So Trevor, known as the young guy in stage one, obviously has now over 20 years of super late model racing under his belt, and a whole other generation has come up and not necessarily impressed Trevor.
The drivers are a lot different now. There's no respect. You get moved. They maul you to death. When I grew up at Beechridge, you know, Bobby and Bob, they didn't care if I was old or young. If I had the hole, they'd let me go. If I was looking, they'd let me go. Now you got an inch on somebody, you know, or somebody's got an inch on you, they're just going to plow you right up off the track. There's just, I don't know, there's no respect.
Do you think there's a way to rein that in, or is the horse out of the barn?
Grumpy old man Trevor Sanborn in stage number two of Open Trailer Podcast. Next time out, I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you for listening.